Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 351, I chat with Dave Abrams, Mike Heiss, and Jeff Tully about what they saw and learned at NAB 2017. So,
netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 27th, 2017. Episode 351, NAB 2017. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week, I've got three guest geeks joining me today. First up is David Abrams, calibrator extraordinaire at Avical. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Nice to have you here. Next up, we have Mike Heiss, a regular contributor to Home Theater Geeks and often a denizen in the chat room. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you. And actually, I'm irregular.
You are somewhat irregular, but definitely a recurring...
That was too much information.
Yeah, right. That may very well be, yes. And speaking of which, we have finally another technology consultant here, Jeff Tully, also a semi-regular member of the panelists on Home Theater Geeks. Hey, Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, always great to have you here. Okay, those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv, can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions for us as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Always helps if you put my name in the message, my screen name, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen and I can see it more easily. So we are gathered here today to talk about NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters Convention, which ended today in Las Vegas, and my three panelists were all there. Sadly, I wasn't, but I have the advantage of having a bunch of friends who were, and so they're here today to talk about what they saw and heard at the show. And what I'd like to start with is something I wrote about last week, which is that NAB, in conjunction with NASA, produced the first live 4K video from space. The International Space Station had a red digital cinema camera, the Epic Dragon, and HEVC encoding. This is the latest version of video compression, high efficiency video codec, otherwise known as H.265. From Amazon Web Services, one of their subsidiaries called Elemental, provided the encoding. That came down to the space station. That came down to the Johnson Space Center, and then got broadcast out by streaming and live to the NAB convention. Now, Jeff, I think you actually attended that event, didn't you?
Yes. In fact, that photo that you saw was a live 4K screen that had been set up in the out in one of the lobby areas nearby, so the people that didn't fit into the room where they had a panel of astronauts and other folks who spoke after this streaming was done. But that stream was coming through there, and you'll notice the what appears to be the horizontal compression involved there is because for some reason they decided to use a massively curved large screen there.
It looks like a deeply curved screen. Why in the world would they do that?
Well, the focal point actually of that is those little cushy pillows down in the on the floor there. That unit, when it was not being used for this, was on all during the day with various show-related graphics and things. And that little iPad that you see to the right on a pedestal there, you could walk over, type your name in it, and a couple of things, and it would build a show themed, you know, the MET logo that they used for this year's show, Media, Entertainment, and Technology, some animation and stuff. And I think the idea was that you would stand in front of that and do selfies of your name and the show logo.
Oh.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the screen was so bright, if you shot the selfie, or at least when I tried it, my face didn't show up.
So this was maybe high dynamic range. What was this a projector on that screen?
No, it was LEDs.
It was LEDs.
Self-lit, whatever. Yeah.
Man, oh man, that is very bright. But what was interesting to me was that this live 4K stream from space was basically a conversation between the commander of the space, current commander of the space station, an astronaut named Peggy Whitson, I believe, who just broke the record for cumulative days in space. She's at 500 and something now. She's also, I think, the oldest woman at 53, I think, if not the oldest astronaut to have held that position. And she's got the most spacewalks, but of a woman anyway. So there was a conversation going on, but I was concerned about the delay between the space station and NAB in Las Vegas with all the processing and streaming and so on. Jeff, did they seem to be able to hold a conversation?
Yeah, from where I was standing now, this in the room here, I wasn't live in the room where the other end of the conversation, the Earth end of the conversation.
Oh, you only heard the space part. Okay.
Well, I heard both parts, but I wasn't seeing the people to give you an idea of the latency.
I see.
From the outside watching it, they weren't pausing to wait for the other person to talk for very long. So it was.
Wow.
It was a nice flow. Made some soap bubbles and infused them with a little bit of colored dye to show, letting go of it every once in a while, letting it float in, gravity-free environment and, some conversation like that. But it seemed fairly comfortable.
One of the most amazing things to me was that I talked to some people at Elemental before this event, and they said that the stream coming down from the space station was at 18 megabits per second, which is very low.
Wow.
Very low. And so I was wondering how compromised they had to compress the you-know-what out of that signal. And so I was wondering how the image looked. What could you tell on that TV you were looking at, Jeff?
The image looked pretty good for that. I mean, it actually looked better to me watching it than it does in that photo. The screen curvature, if I moved around a little bit and got myself, kind of straight on to it. Mm-hmm. The resolution looked quite, you could see a lot of the details. You can't in this photo, but, the room behind him and so on there in the background. Yeah, it was coming through very clear. I was far enough screen heights back. It was no doubt at the very best HD and probably approaching standard def.
As we talk about often on this show, whether or not you can see all the resolution in a picture depends on how close you are to the screen.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because that was a pretty cool thing. Yeah. But getting back to the main part of the show, it seemed to me, one of my first questions is, how is ATSC 3.0 coming along? Because we've seen now that they've been developing the next generation of over-the-air broadcasting. We now have ATSC 1.0, which is high definition, standard dynamic range, a particular gamut of colors called 709. And now we're on the threshold of ATSC 3.0, which will give us 4K, high dynamic range, wider range of colors, immersive audio, and even interactivity. So I'd like to get your guys' hits on where we are with that. What did it look like from NAB's perspective? Mike, let's start with you.
Thanks, Scott. It's funny. I spoke to a bunch of set manufacturers who were there, and they were saying it probably won't make it into sets for this year, but come CES, you will see a lot of it. The standard is almost baked. There are one or two things, but the audio is set. The video is set. They're just a couple of, real inner workings kind of things. And there was a lot of attention to that, not only in their own booth in the lobby, but also with the transmitter and antenna people, because they're a big part of this as well. And then one other thing is what they were promoting, which I think needs to really be reinforced with people, is it's not just about 4K. It was about interactivity, better video, HDR, AWARN, which is the Amber Alerts, hurricane, earthquake, chemical leak type of thing. And they had a beautiful red Ferrari with Nevada license plates, ATSC 3.0, to prove the point that it does mobile. I don't know. Maybe Josh has got some of the pictures for that.
Unfortunately, Jeff sent it to me, but kind of too late. I didn't get it up to Josh in time. Oh, there it is.
That's the one.
That's actually from you, Mike, I think. And that's Brian. That's Brian Markwalter sitting right there in front of the screen. He's the CTO of the CTA, the Senior Vice President of Research and Standards, I think, at the Consumer Technology Association. He's been on the show a couple times. But here we are looking at a live ATSC 3.0 broadcast.
In 4K.
Mm. And high dynamic range?
Yeah. I don't know. That's the Lady Gaga, Tony Bennett thing, which is available in 4K streaming as well. But this was absolutely live from one of the local station transmitters on Black Mountain, right to the convention center. And one of the other things that you see sort of above the Ferrari is where it says hybrid TV. There's also a lot of attention to using a back channel, so that you'll have more interactive things along with just regular TV.
Right. It's got, in fact, a strong internet protocol or IP component to it, which is interesting because, I mean, most TVs these days can be connected to the internet. They've got apps and streaming and so on. So it makes sense that the next generation of over-the-air broadcast would also include an IP component, which means you'd have to have not only an antenna to capture the over-the-air part, but an IP connection to capture that part and do the interactive part. So it's pretty good. As far as HDR is concerned, what are they talking about? I have yet to find a definitive answer about, are they going to use HLG, which is probably what they're going to use, but there are other choices for high dynamic range. Did anybody get any sense of that?
Dealer's choice.
Dealer's choice.
The largest number of people that I heard, and there were a number of presentations on ATSC. In fact, Skip Pitsey of NAB chaired about a half a day worth of half-hour sessions on HDR for broadcasters. And each of the presentations went into different aspects of it. But HLG certainly is sounding like a preference from a number of the broadcast technology people, from the standpoint that it's the easiest to implement in existing, you know, kind of current infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But the Dolby Vision, system, which is, you know, another way of doing HDR, was also showing in their booth, you know, a live to broadcast encoding that allows their system to be handled as well. And my understanding is that their format as it relates to ATSC 3 is, I believe, in balloting now to how it would integrate into the broadcast environment. So it would seem that HLG and Dolby Vision are likely to be available to both. And there's the Thompson Technicolor, Technicolor Phillips.
Technicolor, yeah.
Approach that was also being shown, oriented toward broadcast for HDR. And I would expect them to be in the mix, at least potentially.
Well, I wonder if that means that multiple formats, that different formats could be used, say one broadcaster could use HLG, another one could use Dolby Vision, another one could use Technicolor. If the ATSC 3.0 specification doesn't pick one, then maybe there will be multiple of them, and it becomes something, like I've always said, somewhat like different audio formats are today, right? We have Dolby Digital, we have DTS, we have Dolby Atmos, we have DTSX, and those are all implemented in receivers. And whatever the content is created with doesn't matter. The receiver will detect it, say, oh, this is DTSX, decode it, play it, all is fine. I think the same thing very well could happen with high dynamic range in TVs, as long as the TV has multiple, the ability to process several of them, depending on what comes in.
Well, was anybody, and Scott, we saw that and discussed it from CES. LG, if you remember, had in their booth there a wall of their TV showing that they could decode HLG, Dolby Vision, HDR10.
Mm-hmm. And Technicolor.
In their set. Okay, and maybe the Technicolor.
LG also was demonstrating Technicolor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as Michael and I saw today, Sony has just launched a new OLED set. In conversation with them, they have also multiple decoders planned, either in that set or coming, as an enhancement layer upgrade in that set. So I think that the TV set guys are probably not going to be the gating factor on where this will work. It will largely be the implementation rigors that will determine what goes out there. But certainly the broadcasters are looking at HDR with a lot of enthusiasm. You know, the impact that it has on sports broadcasting and so on, quite good. Interestingly enough, Scott, even more so at this show than I commented on at the HPA Tech Retreat, not always 4K HDR.
Yes. Well, we're going to.
That was really big. There was a lot of talk about that.
We're going to get to that in a minute, and that's a really good topic. And in fact, Jeff, you actually gave a presentation about it here at NAB as well. So we're going to get to that in a minute. But before we do, I want to bring Dave Abrams into the conversation. Dave, you were mostly looking at displays at NAB, right?
That's correct. Yes. Predominantly, my goal was to find the best displays for a lot of the clients that are out there mastering content, that are trying to color grade and author all this content that will hopefully get distributed down this great pipeline if we can get the infrastructure for HDR done and ATSC 3.0 done and to the customer's home. So that was my focus for NAB. Mm-hmm. And we saw a move away, not necessarily away, but we saw a move from the reference grade Sony RGB OLED that a lot of HDR is being mastered on right now today, towards companies coming out now with a 31-inch LCD that they're going to want to get in there and kind of give the Sony a run for its money. It's a 31-inch LCD panel with a dynamic dimming algorithm, if you will, or at least they're trying to implement a dynamic dimming algorithm at the moment.
Is it a fault? Is it a full array local dimming system with an array of LCDs behind the screen?
You know, I think it's going to depend on which manufacturer, but I believe that is what most of them are trying to push.
Yeah, I thought you were talking specifically about the Flanders. Flanders Scientific is a company that produces professional broadcast monitors. Sony also does, as you said, and there were a couple others as well. Ezio, I think, had one.
Yeah, so there's a few, and actually they're all coming out with sort of a I won't want to say similar panel, because you know in displays we know that there are only so many manufacturers, there's only so many panels out there that these manufacturers can choose from, and then really what makes the display great is the technology that drives that panel, right? So you might have a better image processor, a better scaler, better color gamut mapping, better tone mapping, a better backlight algorithm that's controlling your backlight to modulate that. But what we saw was this 31-inch LCD, and it's being manufactured by Panasonic, right? So it's a Panasonic display. It's going to hit 2,000 nits in broadcast, and there are a number of companies that are using this Panasonic LCD, such as TV Logic, such as Flanders Scientific, and there are a number of others that have announced that's coming out later this year. But Azo had a really good demonstration of it at 1,000 nits against the Sony BVM BVM, gosh, you know, the
300,
yes, the
Sony OLED, which is also claims 1,000 nits of peak brightness.
Yes, and they had it at 1,000 nits, and you really got to see it was great demo. It was in a completely dark room. I don't know if Jeff and Mike got to see it, but it was in a completely black room, calibrated about as good as they could get them both to one another, and showing HDR content. You'd really see, like, the OLED would go to a full screen white, right? So we get to this full screen white, and you'd see where the LCD doesn't dim down, and you'd see the OLED kind of clamp down. But then at the same time, you'd see in the demo, they'd show, hey, you know, this really good staircase with this dark red, like, velvet carpet, and the OLED doesn't lose saturation near black. And, you know, as you get to lower saturations, LCDs kind of roll off a little bit. They can't really hold their saturation in lower light scenes. And you got to see it kind of fall away on them. They weren't really trying to hide anything. They're like, here's where we succeed, and here's maybe where we're not quite as good as the OLED. But, hey, you know, we think it's excellent, and no one really wanted to talk price, but we're thinking that, you know, all these people are going to want to try to beat the Sony BVM-X300 on price and say, hey, we've got this panel that in some ways is better, in some ways might not be, but it's kind of the future of grading, especially as those 2000 nit panels from TV Logic and Flanders start rolling out. You know, now you've doubled the amount you can do in your highlights from what the BVM-X300 is capable of. So that was a big thing at the show. Mm-hmm. On the smaller 30-inch monitor side, that was what a lot of companies were pushing. But then on the larger side of displays, we really saw a lot of broadcast manufacturers coming out with panels based on the LG OLED displays. So we saw a lot of 55 inches with SDI inputs coming out with 3D LUTs that can be loaded in to calibrate them and optimize them. And these are more client monitors, right? A review monitor, something that someone's going to have in their color grading bay, that they're reviewing content with producers and directors on and making these creative decisions. But even one step further, Panasonic announced their 65-inch OLED based on the LG panel coming out in September at $6,000. $6,000 retail.
Oh, really? Now, is that, yes, a consumer or a professional? Where's it intended?
It's intended for the professional base, and apparently they're going to limit distribution to the professional market here in the United States. That's what they announced. However, it does have an HDMI input. It does have an HDMI input. So, you know,
yeah, who knows? So it could work. By the way, just so that everybody knows what Dave was just talking about there, SDI is the professional connection between devices. HDMI is more of a consumer type connection, but they serve similar function. The LUT, L-U-T, stands for lookup table, and that is a way of improving the calibration of a display beyond what maybe its own internal controls can do. Or in the case of some TV that has an internal LUT, that allows for a more precise calibration. Did I represent that correctly, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Hey Dave, did you get a chance to look at the Canon? Because they're not well known in the public, but they promote that pretty well as a master grading monitor.
You know, I got to see it briefly from a distance. I didn't get a chance to really go in the little room that they have there. You usually have a room that's pretty dark and giving a good demo. And I don't, was it a new model, Mike?
Yes, they said it was a new model. I you know, it was a big crowd, and I couldn't
I
get
have
in.
One of them, the main one that they were featuring, was actually still labeled as prototype. They had a family of displays, a few different sizes, all of them fairly small. But
I have to say, 2 years ago, one of the Canon HDR prototypes was one of my picks for best picture at the show, because it really looked amazing. Of course, that had something to do with the content as well, and that's another issue, is you can have a high dynamic range display, but unless you have high dynamic range content, you're not going to get the most out of it. Mike, you had a question for me?
Yeah, one or two things. Just remember, though, that Canon, because of their printer and camera business, it's also particularly set as a master monitor for print output rather than video output.
But, good point.
Two other things I wanted to throw in before we leave the ATSC 3.0. Mm-hmm. I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that, unlike now, where you're either 720 or 1080, but you'd never have the same station doing one and the other at different times of the day. It's right. Not outside the realm of possibility that you might see HLG predominantly for live sports and HDR10 not plus, or Dolby Vision for canned content or theatrical type of thing.
Scripted content.
Scripted,
maybe.
Yes. And one other thing about Dave's comment on Panasonic, a little birdie who shall remain unnamed told me that Panasonic may well try to get back into the TV business, and you might see that set. That's all I could say.
Dang!
That's
huge news.
Adamant. I was asking the same question. Are you going to bring it to the consumers? Or are you going to bring it to the consumer market? They were very adamant that no, it's just going to be available for the professional. But maybe that's just the party line. We would love to see.
To be specific, they didn't say that monitor, but they said consumer displays. Because as we all, but you know, we'll see as it goes along. One other display thing, which is way bigger than where David, I think, usually goes, is there were more than one sub-1 millimeter direct view LED displays. And, that was something I first saw at ISC back in February. But, we've all talked about Cletus. You're talking to Joe about the Samsung thing. And there were at least two or three other sub-1 millimeter pitch displays, predominantly intended in this case for behind the news presenters.
Ah, okay. And we have a photo of the 0.9 millimeter LED, courtesy of Mike Heiss. We're going out of order here, Josh. Sorry about that. That's, I think, number 10 or 11. In fact, let me pull it up so that I know what number it is. There it is. This is a very tiny direct LED. It's not an LCD TV. It's LEDs shining directly, and they're so tiny that they can be packed in.
How tiny are they?
They are so tiny that you can't even see them. And yes, the Sony Cletus is another good example. Crystal LED integrated system. Sony Samsung Cinema Screen is another one. And this one, who is this one by? Do you know, Mike?
It was some Chinese, not a brand that I really recognized. And unfortunately, I didn't write it down. But there were two or three of these Chinese vendors, although there's one other thing about Cletus, other than the name change, is that I asked some of the Sony people, and they said they've actually sold a few to residential installations. And I said, how much? And they said, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. But they said they had one integrator buy two of them for one residence.
Wow. For one. So one residence is going to have two of those things.
Yes.
Man. Somebody told me that the Cletus was quite a bit more expensive than the Samsung. And the Samsung is intended only for commercial installations.
I heard commercial twice cinema. As much.
Yeah. Yeah. Holy smokes.
But it'll look really good.
But it'll look really good. Oh, man.
Really good.
You heard Joe Kane talk about how much he liked the Samsung. The only problem, of course, is acoustic transparency. And, how do you get the sound to come directly from the screen? With a projection system, you have a perforated screen or a woven screen, and the sound passes through it. With something like Cletus or the Samsung or this other thing, they're solid pieces of material. You can't get the sound to go through them.
That's why
you got to wait till they get to OLED technology, and then you'll have something like Mike and I just saw today with the new Sony, where they actually vibrate the screen and bring the sound right up.
Oh, yes. Actually, you guys were at Video and Audio Center, an LA retailer, where they had a big launch event at retail for this Sony OLED TV. Dave and I, actually, Dave, you had one in your studio for a little while, and you were gracious enough to invite me over to take a look. And I've just posted on AVS Forum, I want everyone to know, my first look based upon spending a couple hours with that TV in your studio. What was your impression of it while we're on the subject of the Sony OLED?
My Dave. Impression or the guys today at the audio
center? No, let's start with you, Dave.
Okay. I like it a lot. It's an amazing display. I really enjoyed having it in here. And as you know, when we were going through it, the measurements are excellent, and mm-hmm. there are some significant improvements over the 2016 panels from LG. And I'm actually really excited to see what LG is doing with theirs as well. But as you and I know, the image processing that was on the Sony is really, really nice. And the shallow ramps and the colorimetry, they're really starting to nail that. I think, you know, Scott, you actually made it in here when we had the Flanders Scientific grading monitor set up next to it.
Yes.
Without even having to do much more than the internal calibration controls, we were able to get Rec. 709 to match extremely well between the two. It's almost like having a giant 65-inch grading monitor that you can have at home. So I'm a big fan of it so far, and I'd like to see where they're going to go with it in the future, you know, as they improve it and get even wider gamuts and higher light outputs from them.
But not to go off topic,
I asked Sony at the event today about where the Z9 is going to go, and they said we're very, very much going to stick with that. It's not going away, and they sort of see the OLED and the Z9 as complementary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I would agree with that. The Z9 being a fall full array local dimming LCD TV, but like on steroids. I think it's probably the best LCD TV out there today. Jeff, any comments about the event today that you found particularly interesting?
Well, there was a lot of enthusiasm from the press who showed up, and the consumers that were in there. We saw a couple of them being sold as we stood there. So
it was a sales event. Okay, we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was well attended. They drew a really big crowd, and actually Topanga's a fairly hefty drive in morning traffic for people to get out there. But they had a pretty full house, and as you said, you know, I actually saw this display in the booth at Sony. Also, they had it at NAB in one part of their booth, and that, you know, the sound coming out of the screen, and
that's what led us to this particular topic was exactly that. They what they call acoustic surface, which is really cool. I think little actuators, little vibrating voice coils, if you will, attached to the back of the screen, and the screen itself vibrates and that's the speakers on the TV. And it sounds so much better than most of the funky speakers and sound systems that are on these tiny, thin TVs, it's quite remarkable. I thought
and
it was really great.
And the subwoofer on the back.
And the sub, and I wouldn't call it a subwoofer. I'd call it a woofer.
A bass reinforcement device.
bass reinforcement, a BRD. Okay. But basically, if you would think, I would think that, man, if the screen is vibrating, wouldn't you see that? Not if you don't do it to down to low frequencies. So highs and mids can come off the screen. You don't see it at all. But the low frequencies you would see. So they siphon that off to a woofer in the stand of the TV. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, I was going to say they did have some nice demo content to go with this as well. They had clips from the upcoming Spider-Man movie and also some sections from the Ang Lee's movie in full 4K 60
frames per second. That's Billy Lynn's long halftime walk. Yeah.
And that looked remarkable.
Yeah,
it was too video-y for me.
Nah, but that's another. A lot of people say that.
Well, but here, because the screen was so good, at first, before I realized that it was the Billy Lynn picture, I thought it was some footage they captured from somewhere.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Hey well, Scott, listen. Can I answer something that somebody put up in the chat room?
Are you talking about Drew Nielsen?
Yes.
Yes, I was just about to go there, and I knew you would have something to say about it. Drew is asking about the mobile aspect of ATSC 3.0. Will smartphones and tablets have antennas? Will they be able to get it? Mike, I think you have some answers to that.
Yes, that's not only the idea. That's why they had the Ferrari there. They had it was a prototype phone, but they had a phone with the ATSC 3.0 built in, because one of the problems with ATSC 1.0, because of the modulation scheme, it's not OFDM, it's VSB, really doesn't take too well to mobile reception. And that was a very important part of the work that went into ATSC 3.0. And one other answer for Drew, he said, is the 0.9 millimeter the bezel? And the answer is no, that's actually the pitch between the LEDs.
On those direct LED displays?
Yeah.
The pitch meaning the distance between consecutive or
correct.
Next door neighbors. Yeah, exactly. Yes. So ATSC 3.0 will have a mobile aspect. You'll be able to pick it up on smartphones and tablets. I guess they need some sort of antenna, but they probably already have some sort of antenna that must be used for this, as well as, cell phone usage as well, right?
The demo that they had, and I couldn't get a clear shot of it, of the phone that they had mounted in this Ferrari, it was just really bizarre, did not have any little rubber ducky kind of antenna. I believe it was all built in.
Mm, what do you know? well, let's talk about the before we do, Barfel asks, just left, center, and right on that TV, on the Sony? Actually, just left and right. There's just two channels coming off that screen, just left and right. I want to talk a little bit about audio in ATSC 3.0 and otherwise. Obviously, immersive audio is huge these days. Dolby Atmos, DTS:X, Oro. There's actually some Oro news we'll get to in a minute. But who among you had studied at all the audio? I think, Dave, you probably didn't. You were focused on displays. But Mike or Jeff, what did you learn about immersive audio via ATSC 3.0?
Well, it's interesting. For ATSC 3.0, there are two categories of audio, and they're going to also make a big deal about this as well. There's immersive, which is the Atmos or what have you, but then there's also what they call interactive. And part of that is also driven by the broadband connection, but it's the ability to not only have the, if you will, English and Spanish audio tracks, but English, Spanish, French. My favorite is the one they did last year where they had a soccer match and they had a presenter doing the commentary for people who didn't understand soccer. So they had it was hilarious. Now, and I said to them, can you do one with cricket? But and then the guy said back to me, well, but, you know, we don't understand baseball. I said, okay, we're even. But it's interesting. AC4 is the standard for the U.S. ATSC 3.0. The ATSC 3.0 that is already started in Korea is the Fraunhofer MPEG-H. It's another one of those doing the same thing a different way. But one other interesting thing about AC4, and it's
by
not
the way, before you go on, the Dolby made AC4, which is a one format for encoding and carrying audio. Fraunhofer made MPEG-H, which is another one, as you say, different ways of doing the same thing. Go ahead.
No, and it's country by country. So the next battle will be in Europe for DVB-T, where Fraunhofer may well win because they're the home team there. But right. what the Dolby folks said to me earlier in the week at NAB is that AC4 will also be used with streaming, so that there are going to be TV sets, and they showed a Samsung, an LG, and a Sony on the wall in their booth, all with AC4, so that for streaming content, you can use the advantages of AC4 without waiting for ATSC 3.0. I hope I haven't over-acronymed everybody.
Well, this is, man, the business we're in is total alphabet soup. It seriously, seriously is. Anybody learn anything about Oro? That's the in terms of immersive audio, we have Dolby Atmos. And by immersive audio, of course, I mean audio around you this way and overhead. And we have Dolby Atmos, we have DTS:X, and we have Oro. And Oro recently announced some new system.
CX.
CX, that's what it was. Did you learn anything about that?
I not only learned something about it, I heard it. Mm. And what it is their way to get more bitrate efficient. So it's really intended for streaming. And there'll be an object-based version, a channel-based version, but they were really, really intent on saying that this is where, you know, they're really gonna strike through for both streaming and traditional physical media content. And I heard it was in a hotel room kind of thing, and it was pretty good. I mean, it's hard to judge those things, and it did have the traditional high speaker front type of locationing that you get with the traditional big Oro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Drew Nielsen says, well, Dolby's the home team here in the U.S., so maybe that's why they won the U.S. contract, whereas Fraunhofer MPEG-H won the European or Asian contract, and maybe Asian contract. I'd love to turn our attention now to something that I must admit I'm a little hesitant about, and that's 8K. We're just now getting into 4K. What's NHK, the Japanese public broadcasting system, has been showing 8K for many years at NAB. And I get a lot of comments from people who say 8K, and oh man, I just got a 4K set, and next it'll be 16K and 32K, and you know, it's like, man, when does it ever stop? Well, it doesn't, but there does come a point of diminishing returns. Still, yeah, Mike.
This year, I don't know. Did you go to the big theater demonstration they had last year, Scott?
Yes, 8K I did.
Theater. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I went last year. I went the year before, and I went this year. This year, it actually looked good. They had a 340-inch screen with, I think there were five or six projectors, I don't think laser, lighting it up. And this was the first time they showed 8K with HDR. And I was, late to walk in, and I was in the back row, and it looked really, really good. The HDR made a tremendous difference.
Mm, wow. Okay. I wish I'm sorry I missed that. Jeff, did you see that demo?
I did. It was impressive. It was large. and they had an 8K living room set up outside, actually two of them, one that is doable today and one that they talked about called the 8K for 2020, I guess, where they anticipate actually being broadcasting with a, what was it, Michael, 20.4 or 22.4 sound?
22.2.
Oh, the 22.2, which is the same thing they had in the theater, which, interestingly enough, the Oro CX guys, to sort of double back around, said that their 9.1 version of Oro is 90% of the 22.2. So they were using that as a reference.
As an argument. Yeah, or as a reference. Yeah, yeah.
But
and we got a couple of... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the set that Jeff was talking about for the living room of 2020 was meant to be... For now, it was four 65-inch OLEDs sort of glued together, but their goal is to have that as a seamless 120-inch OLED sheet and maybe even bendable.
Yeah, we've got a couple pictures to show about this particular thing. Let's take a look at number 4 and 5. Just want to make sure I got my numbers straight here. So here's their sort of concept, right? Of a flexible OLED screen, maybe rolling down from a mechanism at the top, and then the number 2 is Mike's actual picture of the display there. And as you can see, yeah, that's four OLEDs kind of stuck together.
And notice the little sign at the bottom. It was 8K, 120 hertz, 22.2. And again, for those who are watching, the mullions were obviously just because they don't have the big sheet yet. And the thing that was cool, you see the little sign where it said, it's thin. It was really thin.
Dave, did you happen to get over to NHK to see any of their stuff?
I did, yes. Yes, I didn't get to go in the theater, but I did see the two living rooms that they're talking about. And my first thing when I walked in was, oh, the room of the future, it's going to have borders in our TVs again. We're going backwards. we're going to LCD video walls with, you know, the borders all around them. But as they said, you know, it was just proof of concept. And unfortunately, there were a lot of people in there when I went by. So I was probably about 15 to 20 feet away, which I didn't really see the benefit of the 8K, you know, being that far away. But
right, but
it was impressive. And they did have the speakers, and it was an impressive demo.
Mm-hmm. But I think Dave is right that they did themselves a disservice, because a lot of people walked by and saw that and they said, you know, like, what is this, a video ball wall? Why are there mullions? And if it were me, I wouldn't have shown it that way.
Mm, yeah. Coulda, woulda in the chat room is saying not just 8K, 8K at 120 frames per second, which is really an important distinction with HDR.
Yeah, it was really good in the theater.
Sounds really good to me. The other thing that NHK was talking about was augmented reality TV. And we actually have a picture of that as well.
Yes, I was going to.
Jeff, would tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, this one they had, I lost on my screen the feed here. Okay, what you're seeing there is the picture. They had it set up with a television set, and I think it was an 8K TV mounted sideways, like you see it there, with a movie showing on it. And then they had a tablet sitting in front of it taking a picture of that screen, showing it live, so you could move the tablet around and the TV would be moving around. And then they had an animation which you saw happen on the tablet of a figure coming out, literally out from the screen, and then floating around in the space in front of the TV set. Of course, you're looking at the TV set live, and there's nothing floating around in the room.
That strikes me as odd. I mean, if you're watching TV, you got a nice big screen in front of you, and then you've got this little tablet maybe in your lap or whatever, and it's showing you something popping out of the screen. I mean, why would you be looking at this little tablet when you've got this big TV up there?
Well, because it's showing you this creature that's
you a dinosaur popping out of the TV.
Well, it's also because I know that both you and Leo really like 3D TVs so much that this is the next thing. And you really have to show that to Leo, because I know he'll want to order one right away.
Right away. Yeah, no doubt about it.
but there was a lot of attention there outside of the NHK booth to AR, and particularly to VR. There were some really wild capture rigs. There was one with 35 Samsung DSLRs for
that's number nine. There it is. Look at that.
You know, it looks like the finish line at a race or under the goalposts. which is what they were showing there. But I think that the question isn't, is it doable? There were a lot of people saying, like, why do we want to? Where's the monetization? Everything has to be monetized. Mm-hmm. And
Well, everything does have to be monetized. There's no doubt about that, because otherwise, how's it going to get paid for?
Yep.
Okay. I love the note you sent me, Mike, about you can't wait for the first VR bar mitzvah.
You betcha. And I want to see Grandma putting the goggles on.
There were a number of 8K cameras there, too, as there have been for a number of years, mostly only from NHK, but now from Astro. We have a picture of the Astro 8K cam there, Mike, that you took.
Yep,
so,
there were about three or four of them.
Right. So are we really moving towards 8K? Dave, what do you think? I mean, is 4K only, as some people have said, a stopping point a momentary respite on the mad dash towards 8K, or is that still kind of farther in the future?
I think on the production side, there's always that mentality of, hey, let's produce at the highest rate we possibly can and make the highest quality master that we can so that we are more future resilient.
That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. I agree.
And remaster kind of, but on the consumer display side, I think we're a very long time away from 8K. I don't think we're going to have the 8K distribution and the 8K displays that we're watching at our homes. As soon as a lot of people think, I know they were saying what 2020 on the NHK demo for that larger OLED, and maybe some of these larger screens that are 120 inches plus might have it. But again, I don't think we'll see the content that soon in the home. I think just for the vault, you know, for the movie vault here in Hollywood, they'll master at a higher rate and a higher resolution, and then they'll be able to create whatever they want below that from there.
Mm, and that, just remember, it takes a whole bucket of bits to get that to the home. And the NHK people were saying, we're going to do it on satellite. In fact, they have a test up now on what they call their BS system. I don't make it up. I just report it.
Okay.
And you look at what's going to happen to try and get ATSC 3.0 up, and satellite in the U.S. You know, DirecTV is really trying to push people to streaming, and you look into the monetization again, and what's the pipe that they're going to push all of that through?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. I think Dave's point is also well taken, you know, that for archiving and for original capture, you do want to capture as high a quality as you possibly can. That doesn't mean it's going to be distributed at 8K, but if you can capture at 8K, then as you say, you're future resilient and it'll last a lot longer.
You know, Scott, there's also a big thing just slowly over time. We're seeing it become more and more, but we were seeing it more and more on the hardware side is IP video, you know, that's,
oh yeah.
And so that pipe all of a sudden, you know, can open up once we start going IP video infrastructures.
Just to make sure everybody understands what you're talking about there is shuttling content back and forth within a production facility.
Well, yes,
it's within a production facility right now.
Yeah.
But eventually more towards the consumer, right? Think about having your, you know, we remember the Kaleidoscape, but think about having a Kaleidoscape that you have at your home in LA and you happen to have a home in Aspen and you could stream your own content at a high quality from your Kaleidoscape, let's say from LA to that home in Aspen. So that video becomes ubiquitous no matter where you are. Again, watching anything, anywhere is sort of where everyone wants to go with this. And with packet, you know, IP-based video, you're able to make that more of a reality quicker, and you'll be able to deliver, I think, higher quality video faster than we can with the infrastructures that we, you know, the legacy infrastructures that we have today that we're working within.
Okay.
Well, as a good example, you talked about SDI before, Scott. Mm-hmm. SDI or HDSDI are pretty quickly beginning to be replaced where the budgets allow by IP. The new ESPN's facility up in Connecticut is all IP. There's no SDI in it.
Unfortunately, there won't be anybody in that facility.
Well, that's another story.
We only heard yesterday that ESPN is laying off 100 on-air talent people because they're losing money now. They used to be Disney's cash cow, but no longer. Kind of interesting there, which may very well have something to do with IP delivery, because now at home, you know, we got streaming, of course. All these TVs have streaming apps on them. And I have to say, Dave, to your point about how you can, you know, in IP, the pipe opens up. Yes and no, because I'll give you an example. When I was at your place, you let me hang out in your studio. You had to go do something else. And I was watching the Sony OLED, as we were talking about earlier. And I was watching UHD Blu-ray. And it looked phenomenal, just great. Then I went to Netflix and I watched Daredevil, a little bit of it, which was 4K, high dynamic range, streaming. And it looked so much grainier, so much noisier than UHD Blu-ray. And it made me think immediately, man, I mean, Netflix is probably compressing the you-know-what out of it to get it down the pipe. The pipe is only so big, and it's going to get bigger over time. But for now, it is kind of smaller. Go ahead.
And that is the problem, right? That is the problem. Today, IP video is too compressed. So, you know, we wouldn't see the quality we're going to see from Ultra HD Blu-ray. Not today, but those infrastructures and, you know, those infrastructures are being built out very, very quickly. So I think we'll see that, you know, from data center to, you know, my little lab here, we'll see that pipe get bigger and bigger, I think, fairly quickly. And as, you know, again, as compression gets better and better, right now, IP video is far too compressed to, you know, do that 8K delivery. But again, you know, we saw 4K first kind of distributed through these internet streaming apps. And so
it wouldn't be too much
to assume that when 8K comes, we'll probably see it first through these internet streaming apps as well.
Yeah. Coulda Woulda in the chat room is saying 8K is useful to eliminate visible pixels at touchscreen interaction distances. So I think that makes some sense.
Well, and
it's also a good way to distribute newspapers. You can, you know, take a photograph of the newspaper page and read them with a small microscope on your 70 or 80 or 100 inch wall. I actually saw somebody demoing that. You know, this is how good the resolution is. You can, you know, put your face 6 inches away from the screen and read the fine text on some photograph of a document that they have.
Yeah, but then I'd have to take my glasses off.
No, we don't want that. We don't want that.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Scott, are you able to see the emails that I just sent over to you a little bit ago?
Yes, I am.
Not a movie might be small enough. The 8K Sports.
Oh, that's a movie or the still?
No. There's one still and one movie. The movie's probably too big to push up, but if you send the still up, I could describe a little bit. It's an actual credible use for 8K cameras in.
Okay, well, I can't put it up, but Josh can, so I'm going to send it to him.
Right, yeah.
And hopefully.
In that Astro booth, the 8K there, and there was one other Foray, F-O-R-R-A. They were promoting 8K just the way 4K was originally promoted for replays.
Yep. Yeah, this one was showing, potentially a live broadcast of a football game, where you would be cutting out a segment of the screen and blowing it up to just a full HD for output. But you had a single 8K camera planted back far enough that it was seeing the entire football field. And then you do cutouts. And obviously, if you're recording that and storing it, then instant replay, you could go to any other part of the field. Not just the play that aired. There you go. What you see on the top screen is the output of the screen, and down below is the full field you see is in the frame, and that little highlighted box is what's being actually sent out to the upper screen. And that small box in the video that I sent you, Scott, moves around and actually changes. You can zoom it and whatever and show the action on the screen of any place there with one camera instead of four or six or eight.
Gotcha. And some of those for slow motion, I can't grab my notebook. It's at the other end of the desk. Some of the cameras were like 400, 600, 800 frames per second. So that you get slow-mo along with the zoom-in that Jeff was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, clearly, you know, I've heard a lot of people with regard to cameras, still cameras even, say, oh, you know, once you get past a certain number of megapixels, it doesn't matter. It does if you're going to zoom in and crop and maybe move around, as you've just described. So I think the megapixel war has some merit in that regard. Okay, let's see here. We got a couple minutes left. And I did want to show Mike, you always come up with some pretty goofy things that are pretty cool. And one of them is the Panasonic balloon cam.
It is balloon.
Here we have a great picture of that you took, the balloon cam. There it is.
it's a drone with a camera and the little smiley face, there's a projector inside and they do projection mapping. And it was really cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. okay, here's user 7115, whose real name is Hamit. He's a regular watcher, and thank you so much for being here, Hamit. For those that say 8K today, then 16, then 24, where does it end? My question would be more, when does it represent human sight? That's the stopping point. And that's exactly right. I'm still working on trying to get an ophthalmologist, an eye doctor, on the show to talk about what are the limitations of human vision. At some point, as I said, I think earlier, there is a point of diminishing returns in terms of if you want to see that whole, all of that resolution all at once, then it becomes less important, except for the applications we're talking about here, as zooming in and cropping and being able to still get a high resolution image out of part of the image that you capture.
And also for taking the cuts out of a theatrical production and use it for print.
Yes. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, another piece too, and I did see this. It was in the Showstoppers press event before the NAB opened, and then also in the new technology section in Ericsson's booth. They were showing, speaking of the value of 8K, 4K, relative to HD, virtual reality, you know, put on the headset and look anywhere.
Oh, yeah, 360. Man.
And 4K is, and HD have been used for streaming, VR kinds of experiences to headsets. And one of the researchers at Ericsson had built a kind of a demo that he was showing, that he was using to try and understand how much resolution is needed to make the VR experience look real as you vary content. And what he had on the headset, you put it on and he would say, look straight ahead till you see move your head around until you see a little dividing line top to bottom on the screen. Everything to the right of that, you turn your head, you see a little text superimposed that says 8K. You turn to the left and it says 4K. And if you turn your head all the way around, look behind you, it's HD. And the video that's playing as you do that is in these three different resolutions of a variety of different scenes. One was standing on a cliff overlooking ocean and scenery and stuff like that. I think another one was a crowd scene in some kind of retail environment. And it was quite striking that, the HD just was blurry and fuzzy. And
You can see the pixels probably.
Almost, yeah. And then the 4K really was still out of focus and not that engaging. And the 8K, one of the shots was actually inside an aeronautics museum, and you could actually look down at the signs in front of some of the exhibits make out
and
the text. the larger text. Now, again, remember that the 8K is all of that 360-degree view. It's not your field of view through the glass.
Right, right, right. You know, which is another problem.
Not getting anywhere near the readability of text that you do on a flat 8K that's only filling part of your field of vision. This is they're trying to carry enough information to map it into that headset. Mm-hmm. And what he was basically finding is that for certain kinds of content, even 8K is barely enough, and they're more looking at, as you map the way that your head turns, you calculate and put 8K in front of where you're looking and maybe fill the periphery with 4K and don't even bother to transmit the stuff that's behind your head. Of course, that means if you suddenly snap your head around, you'll be staring into a black screen or a blur.
Into the abyss.
Yeah, whatever.
Well, there's another part of that that goes to the question that Hamid asked is how much resolution do you need in the capture side? Remember, the goggles are per eye. So if you're shooting in 4K, you can get 2K or regular HD per eye. It's the same thing we had back in the 3D days so long ago. If you're shooting in 4K, you get full HD per eye. You're not looking at 4K, you're looking at 2K. So if you have an 8K content, and if the goggles are 4K, 4K per eye. That's why you need the 8K.
Mm-hmm. Makes total sense to me. And I have to say that all the VR I've seen so far it's not compelling visually to me at all. I can see the pixel structure. It's kind of soft and fuzzy. It really does need that super, super high resolution, I think. So there's an application for it right there. Dave, do you have any...
You can throw up quicker.
What's that?
So you can throw up quicker.
Yeah, right. Dave, do you have much experience with VR?
Not a lot of experience with VR, no. More of just an enthusiast of VR. But the calibration side of VR is done... within the system for the most part, for the stuff that can be calibrated. So we haven't really had an opportunity to really work too much with the glasses and making measurements and, you know, working on the technical side of it. But it's an interesting up and coming technology here.
Yeah, it really is. And you bring up a great point about calibrating the glasses, the goggles. I had not heard of that before, I hadn't even thought of that before, but that's a really excellent point. How in the world do you manage to assure that what you're looking at is what it looks like, what the creator intended it to look like? I mean, that's a good question, and we don't know the answer yet.
One of the big uses for VR and particularly for AR is for mechanic training, aircraft mechanic trainings, physician training, and all of that. So if you're using an AR or VR system to train a surgeon, I'd want the thing to be calibrated. I'd have him call Dave.
So we've had a few studios that we've worked with that are doing VR content for some of the different systems out there. And in discussing with the manufacturers of the glasses themselves, a lot of the glasses are locked down where there's not a really good way to get in there and, let's say, load a lookup table or adjust your gain or your bias controls within the glasses themselves. Now, that may be changing. It's been a few months since we've really worked with some of the studios on this. But what we were going to be able to do and what may still happen is putting patterns through the VR creation process. So, you know, generating it from the computer as if it was the VR, profiling the glasses themselves. So measuring the grayscale, the gamma, the color gamut mapping, and then creating a lookup table that then lives in the source device to curve the content to then be calibrated within that pair of glasses that you've profiled.
Interesting. Okay. Well, listen, there's so much more to talk about, and the future looks bright. What was that song? The future is so bright, I have to wear shades. Anyway, we've run out of time, so I want to thank you all very much for being here and sharing your observations from the National Association of Broadcasters, NAB 2017. Let me also remind people that Dave Abrams will be here again in 2 weeks to talk about the Sony A1e OLED that we both had a chance to take a look at and Dave calibrated. I'm getting one, actually, Dave. I'm getting one in my house in the next few days from Sony to do more reviewing on. So I will be calling upon you maybe to come over and check it out with me.
That sounds great. And I may, very, very well may, have an LG coming in before we do our interview as well.
Ooh, so a little comparison. That'll be very nice. Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
And Mike Heiss, always a pleasure to have you here. Plenty of interesting stuff and great pictures that you took at the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, my pleasure, and hello to all the friends in the chat room.
Yes, and of which there are many. And finally, Jeff Tully, thank you again for being here. You're a stalwart member of my panel crew, and I always appreciate it.
All right. Glad to be here. Always fun.
You bet. to reach Dave Abrams, you can go to avical.com. That's AVICAL.com. Mike Heiss, I think the best place for people to read your stuff is at twice.com, right?
Yes, or residentialsystems.com.
Or residentialsystems.com. Twice.com is This Week in Consumer Electronics. And so plenty of stuff there for you to read. And Jeff, you're just sort of floating around the internet. I don't think you have an online home at this point, right?
Right. I mean, my first name at Tully.com gets an email right to me.
Oh, so if you want to email him, there you go. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. And you can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Kaushik Sundar. He is a research scientist at a company called OSIC, which is about to release a very interesting pair of headphones, which do immersive audio in a really interesting and unique way. And in fact, I experienced a demo of these headphones with a VR rig that was quite astonishing. I still wasn't really taken by the video, but the audio was pretty remarkable. So I'm going to have Kaushik on next week to talk about the technology that he's developing with OSIC for these OSIC X 3D headphones. Should be great. So I do hope you will join us for that. And until then, geek out.